morning. Coming up next at 11 o'clock on KBOO Portland is Health Watch. Today, host Dr. David Naiman speaks with acclaimed science writer and explorer David Qualman about the story of Ebola, its past, present, and its unknowable future. And at 11:30 on Health and Healthcare Forum, we hear a conversation with psychologist Margarita Alegria about how some neighborhoods may be associated with issues of esteem that lead to higher rates of mental illness than other locales. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support in our recent mini-membership drive. We exceeded our goal with your great help, so that is just fabulous.
This song could go on without any end, till you realize that your car is not your friend. We're all car addicts, let's just say no, then those cars will have to go.
Help support KBOO Community Radio by donating your used car, truck, motorcycle, boat, or any other vehicle. We'll transform that old machine into resources for unserved and underserved communities, free training, recording equipment, and great programming for the Portland metro area, Cascadia, and the world. For more information, call 1-877-526-6123. That's 877-KBOO-123. Or go to kboo.fm/vehicle.
Tune in to KBOO on December 24th at 7 p.m. for a Christmas gift from KBOO to you. The premiere of Nick Devlin's musical, Noel Noel. A heartwarming radio broadcast with 12 original Christmas songs, Noel Noel tells the story of a diverse group of friends who celebrate the holidays in their own unique way. What they lack in riches, they make up for in love. Poor Christmas will never be the same. Noel Noel, broadcast Wednesday, December 24th at 7 p.m. here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest, David Qualman, is an award-winning journalist and author who covers exploration, field biology, and human survival in remote landscapes, often on assignment for National Geographic magazine. He's been honored with 3 National Magazine Awards and an Academy Award from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. David Qualman has also been on the trail of the Ebola virus, making 18 trips to Africa since 1999 and writing an article for National Geographic in 2007 entitled Deadly Contact, which recounted an outbreak of Ebola in a remote African village. His research into Ebola eventually led to the books Spillover in 2012 and now his latest best-selling book, Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. The New York Times says David Qualman is not just among our best science writers, but among our best writers. Welcome to Health Watch, David Qualman.
Thank you. Very good to be with you.
So, David, did you end up writing Ebola, or were you prompted to write Ebola and update what you wrote in Spillover because of the latest outbreak in West Africa?
Yes, absolutely. The new book, little book, Ebola, is drawn to a great extent from sections of Spillover that discussed Ebola, the ecology, the origins of the virus, the history of human outbreaks, and the search for the reservoir host of Ebola, where it lives when it's not killing humans. My British publisher asked me if I would pull out those sections and write some new material and create a standalone book that would help people in the midst of this very scary and confusing Ebola crisis in West Africa, help them to understand the virus in larger context.
Well, one of the really nice things you do in both of the books is you start out by establishing the terms for people who aren't familiar with biology or epidemiology. And one of the things you point out at the beginning is that Ebola is a zoonotic disease versus other diseases like smallpox or polio, which aren't zoonotic. So can you tell us what zoonosis is so that our
listeners... Yeah, this is crucial. Zoonosis is an animal infection that's transmissible to humans, something that comes from non-human animals and spills over. That's the reason for the title of my 2012 book, spills over into human victims. And that includes, a large range, both of the most notorious older diseases like bubonic plague, but also many of the new scary emerging diseases, particularly viruses such as Ebola and Marburg and SARS and MERS. These zoonotic infections, they can be bacterial, they can be fungal, but most of the scariest new ones are viral. They emerge from non-human hosts because they get an opportunity to get into humans because of human contact with wildlife usually.
And typically the reservoir host, the host that is harboring the virus that then spills over into humans, isn't affected in the same way. It's not an obvious illness necessarily for the reservoir host. Is that right?
That's right, yeah. The reservoir host by definition is the species of creature in which the virus lives endemically, inconspicuously, over the long term, without causing noticeable symptoms. It does that presumably because it has a very old relationship with that animal, or it could be a plant also, but most of the human viruses of concern come to us from vertebrate animals. The virus, whatever it is, lives in this reservoir host, some species of, might be a rodent, might be a bat, might be a primate, chimpanzee, or a monkey, lives there inconspicuously without causing symptoms, replicating at relatively low levels, and then when it gets into a new kind of host, a new species, such as humans, in some cases it goes wild, it replicates very abundantly and causes disease and sometimes terrible disease that might be both transmissible, highly transmissible among humans, and in some cases also extremely virulent and fatal.
So the real mystery at the core of spillover and Ebola is, what is Ebola's reservoir host, which we still don't have a definitive answer of what the reservoir host is for Ebola. But you really learn about in your book about all of these heroes, whether they're ecologists or biologists or laboratory scientists who are risking their lives to try to figure out which animal, which creature is quietly hosting this virus that keeps spilling over periodically.
That's right. That's right. Each of these new emerging diseases is essentially a mystery story. That's one of the things that made it relatively easy to write about, and I hope makes it easy to read about. Each of these is a mystery story, and the people who go out, the disease ecologists and wildlife veterinarians and epidemiologists and others who go out and try and solve the mysteries surrounding these new emerging diseases, are the detectives, are the heroes of both of my books on this subject. And in the case of Ebola virus, as you mentioned, David, after 38 years since the first known outbreak of Ebola virus, we still don't know what the reservoir host is. We don't know the identity of that creature in which it lives secretively and conspicuously. You hear people say, it's fruit bats, African fruit bats. And fruit bats are at the top of the list of suspects, but it has not been confirmed. The absolute gold standard proof of the reservoir host relationship has not been established. That requires isolating live virus from the species in question, and that has never been done with Ebola virus. No one has ever isolated live Ebola virus from a non-human animal of any sort in Africa or anywhere else. So that search goes on.
Well, I was really fascinated to learn that populations of gorillas and chimpanzees are being decimated by the Ebola virus in Africa, as well as humans, but doubly surprised that we don't ever seem to hear about that. Why do you think that is? Do you think it's just sort of human self-interest that we're not talking about populations of gorillas that are disappearing from the Ebola virus?
Well, I guess so, yeah, this has been a terrible crisis, particularly for the lowland gorilla in central Africa. Scientists on the ground there estimate that thousands, maybe tens of thousands, of gorillas have been killed by Ebola over the last 10 or 20 years. The great apes, and that in Africa that means chimpanzees and gorillas, are highly susceptible to Ebola. It affects them very adversely. It kills them very quickly. There has been evidence collected from gorilla carcasses and chimpanzee carcasses of Ebola infection. It passes from one to another. Nobody knows exactly how many it's killed, but the great apes in Central Africa, the chimps and the gorillas, are already highly threatened. I think they're technically endangered species. They might be merely threatened on the endangered species list, but anyway, they are declining drastically because of hunting and habitat loss, but now we know also that they're declining because of Ebola infection.
And your book seems to suggest that ecological disturbance and habitat disturbance is part of what raises the risk and causes these episodic breakouts of Ebola as well.
That's right. Every species of animal, plant, fungus, bacteria on the planet carries its own unique forms of virus infecting those various different kinds of organisms. And so in the more diverse, the most diverse ecosystems, including the equatorial forests, where there are many, many, many species of animals, plants, and these other organisms, there are also many, many kinds of so far unidentified, undiscovered viruses. And when we humans go into those forests and cut down trees and build our settlements and our timber camps and our logging, our mining camps, and kill the wildlife and eat it, we expose ourselves to those new viruses from all these other species. We give them the opportunity to leap, to spill over from their reservoir host into humans. And that's one of the important factors driving this trend around the world, but particularly in the tropics, of new emerging diseases coming to us from wildlife. It's not because the viruses are looking for us, it's because we're intruding upon the animals in which they live and exposing ourselves, giving them the opportunity to become human viruses.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to science writer and journalist David Quammen about his latest book, Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. So far, Ebola, David, is considered a dead-end virus. What does that mean?
Well, among humans, it was considered a dead-end, and probably still is. Humans are a dead-end host in the sense that it spills over occasionally every few years into human populations. It causes terrible illness, it causes deaths, and then in the past it has either died out or it has been stopped. There have been about 23 previous outbreaks of Ebola virus in Africa, and none of those killed more than about 300 people. The total number of fatalities before this year from Ebola was only about 1,800 people. In each of those cases, international and national health authorities showed up on the scene, in some of those cases anyway, and instituted the medical procedures that stop Ebola. Barrier nursing, gowns, gloves, masks, cautious disposal or burial of dead victims, isolating contacts, isolating cases, tracing contacts, and separating people from infected people so that the virus cannot pass anymore. It passes only by direct contact with bodily fluids, and if you cut down that possibility, then you stop the virus, and that's happened in the past. But now with this horrible situation in West Africa, it's gone from being an outbreak to being a genuine epidemic in those countries. It's continuing, and in Sierra Leone, apparently, the numbers of cases are continuing to rise. it's not likely, not at all likely, to be the next big pandemic that spreads around the world and affects millions of people and kills tens or hundreds of thousands. That's more likely to be a different kind of virus. But so far in 2014, unfortunately, Ebola has not come to a dead end in humans. And when we need to do everything we can to help those West African countries bring it to a close, bring it to a dead end.
Will you describe how every time that there's a spillover event, that the virus goes from the reservoir host into humans, that it's like the virus is playing the lottery and that there's a long shot chance every time it spills over that this time it won't be a dead end event? Is that because the virus is altering and adapting to the human host each time, or is it just different circumstances that the virus is finding each time it plays the lottery?
Well, viruses don't have intentionality, of course, but they are subject to Darwinian natural selection. So each time they get into a new host, a new kind of host, if they find they can replicate, then the numbers increase, the virus is mutating, because viruses tend to mutate. They make mistakes in replicating themselves, and that mutation is random, but it represents the raw material for Darwinian natural selection, and that means the possibility of adaptation. If the virus mutates in such a way that does allow it to adapt to humans as distinct from its original host, its reservoir host, then it can become a very significant human virus. Ebola so far has not done that, but think back just a few decades. There was a virus that was living in chimpanzees, and we now refer to it as simian immunodeficiency virus, chimp, and it spilled over from a single chimpanzee into a single human in the southeastern corner of Cameroon back around the beginning of the 20th century. We know this now from good genetic work, and it became the AIDS pandemic. It became the pandemic strain of HIV. Now, there was a virus that won the lottery in terms of Darwinian success. It went from being a virus infecting a creature that's declining, as I said, chimpanzees, to being a virus of humans. 7 billion of us around the world are its potential habitat, and at this point it has infected about 70 million people, of whom 35 million have already died.
So this latest 2014 Ebola outbreak, which seems different in terms of its scope and scale, do we have a sense of whether that's because of a strain of Ebola being particularly virulent, or is it having to do more with the inadequacies of the human response?
Almost certainly the latter. It's a public health crisis, and it's probably not a matter of a new strain of Ebola that is better adapted to human transmission. What we're seeing happening in West Africa probably reflects the ugly facts of poverty and overcrowding and inadequate health care, inadequate expenditure of money on health infrastructure, materials and training, decades of crippled governance in those three poor countries. Probably reflects those ugly facts more than it reflects the ugly facts of Ebola virus itself taking a new form. We know that this strain of Ebola has been mutating. There's been some good scientific work published on that, but there's no evidence so far that it has adapted to be either more transmissible or more lethal in humans than previous strains of this particular species of Ebola virus.
Can you talk about some of the misconceptions about the symptoms of Ebola, perhaps originating from the book Hot Zone?
Yes, people are particularly scared of this virus, and to some extent for good reason, because it has a high case fatality rate, and it's a nasty, nasty virus, but in some cases because they have misconceptions about this particular spooky thing that we call Ebola virus. People have the impression that it causes extraordinarily bloody disease in humans. Well, in some cases it's bloody, but it's not invariably bloody. Probably in less than half of the cases does it cause cause catastrophic hemorrhaging. It does not cause people's internal organs to dissolve, to deliquesce, to melt down. And people have had these ideas, and it has made Ebola seem like not just a virus, but some sort of a preternatural miasma. And it's not. It is just a very nasty virus that requires transmission by direct contact with bodily fluids. It can be controlled. I suppose the other reason that it seems spooky to people is because it comes out of the African forest, and most people have only the faintest inchoate ideas about the African forest. I've spent a lot of time in the African forest, forests of Central Africa, particularly myself, and they're not for everybody, but they're really lovely, wonderful ecosystems, and when you're there, Ebola virus is among the last things that you're thinking about.
And how? What is your feeling on the U.S. response in terms of what it's doing well or poorly in aid when it comes to the West African outbreak?
Yeah, well, I think the U.S. has stepped up rather well, better than virtually any other country in the world in terms of providing partnership and assistance to those three countries in West Africa that are trying to stop this virus. We've sent our military over there. We've sent a lot of money and supplies and brave volunteers over there. We could be doing more, and I wish we were doing more, but we've been doing more than most other countries on the planet. Cuba has been helping, China has been helping, Great Britain has been helping, independent organizations like Médecins Sans Frontières have been helping. All that has been wonderful, but it hasn't been enough, and there's been disorganization on the ground there that has contributed to the continuation of the thing. In terms of the U.S., I don't think we have done especially well at understanding this phenomenon, either understanding the virus or understanding the situation in West Africa. We had our little scare in the U.S. when Thomas Eric Duncan, the man from Liberia, went to Dallas and was in the hospital and died and then infected two nurses. I don't think anybody yet knows exactly how those nurses became infected, but they weren't supposed to become infected. People had been told that healthcare workers in the U.S. with proper equipment and training wouldn't become infected, and then those two women did become infected, and that scared the bejesus out of a lot of people around the country. But in fact, we haven't had any severe situation with Ebola in this country, and we're not likely to. And notwithstanding those two anomalous cases, we have dealt with it in the U.S. the way it should be dealt with. So I think people should be still very concerned about what's going on in Africa, but not worried for their own safety.
And what are your thoughts in terms of quarantine of returning healthcare workers, or you know, different during the panic that happened during the three cases of Ebola that the United States have had? It seemed like there were all these suggestions, some of them coming from surely from a place of fear and panic, that to have stricter rules around people coming back who could have been exposed. Is that a calamitous idea? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think it was a reasonable thing for us to discuss. I don't think we discussed it very calmly and lucidly. I mean, people were entitled to say yes. If people are coming into the country from those three countries in West Africa, well, what precautions are we taking? Are we screening them at airports? Are we taking temperatures? Is there mandatory quarantine? I don't think that was ever a very practicable or useful idea. People could always come into this country by indirect routes. So there was a lot of smoke that went up around that discussion of how to deal with people flying into the U.S., either Americans returning or West Africans coming here, and it's a complicated question, and I'm not going to say, okay, here's exactly what should be done and how it should be done. I was glad to see that it was discussed, but I wasn't very happy about the level of rational discourse that we brought to that.
Well, I presumed in reading the book that your past history as a fiction writer played a role in how engaging it was, because I learned a lot about biology.
My deep secret past history as a fiction writer, David.
but seriously, David, I learned a ton about biology and epidemiology and about the Ebola virus specifically, but also a lot of really interesting things culturally in Africa too. But what really struck me was how deeply engaging it was as a story. I know it's a terrible story, but it's from a dramatic and narrative perspective. You really, I could see this as strangely as a great movie, but it was also just a really compelling read.
Well, thank you very much. I really appreciate that. It's a serious subject, as you say, but I also feel like when a person writes a book on however serious a subject, there's a requirement to be entertaining as well as instructional. And as I said, it was easy with this book because there are all these great mystery stories and these courageous detectives who are going out and working on them. So I tried to take advantage of that and do justice to the narrative element of the subject.
I was curious on the narrative level. I know that we've known about Ebola since, I think, the 70s, but you start the book with a specific outbreak in Gabon in 1996. Was there something compelling about starting there?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, that was where it started for me. I was on assignment for National Geographic in 1999 and 2000, and in July of 2000, I was walking with an American ecologist and explorer named Mike Fay across a big block of pristine forest in northeastern Gabon, and it was great gorilla habitat, but the gorillas were missing. It was empty of gorillas. We were noticing that, and it was also Ebola habitat. There had been an Ebola outbreak on the edge of this forest at a village just a few years before. And so over the campfire one night, I started hearing about this Ebola outbreak in the village from two of our camp crew, guys who were walking with us through this forest. And they were telling me about their friends and loved ones dying of this. And it was horrible to hear about. And then one of them said, David, there was a strange thing. At around the same time, we saw a pile of 13 dead gorillas nearby in the forest. And I wrote that phrase in my notebook, and it was inscribed in my memory. I knew that those 13 dead gorillas had probably died of Ebola virus, so that was the beginning of my interest in zoonotic diseases. Ebola, killing gorillas and killing humans and living in some secret reservoir, some other species, so it represented the connectedness of the natural world with humans included, in this case connectedness by way of disease. But I always like writing about the connectedness of humans with the natural world, and this was another way of doing that.
And do any top organizations come to mind that if people were interested in helping out in some way?
Absolutely. I've been giving what money I can to Doctors Without Borders, and I certainly I have no direct connection with them, but from what I've heard about their work in West Africa, I would highly recommend Médecins Sans Frontières. Doctors Without Borders is somebody deserving of support. In addition, there are organizations like EcoHealth Alliance in New York City, filled with some of these heroic disease detectives I've been talking about, who work on this problem over the long term of emerging zoonotic diseases. So, yeah, Doctors Without Borders and EcoHealth Alliance are my two favorites.
And what about a website for you? Do you have somewhere we can point our listeners to?
I'm very easy to find on the web. My site is simply www.davidquammen.com.
Great. Well, it was a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, David.
Thank you so much, David. Really a pleasure talking with you, too.
We are talking today to science writer David Quammen about his latest book, Ebola, The Natural and Human History of a Deadly Virus. You've been listening to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host.
KABU at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show Five Broken Cameras on Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. The first ever Palestinian film to be nominated for Best Documentary Feature, Five Broken Cameras is a deeply personal first-hand account of life and nonviolent resistance in a West Bank village surrounded by Israeli settlements. Shot by Palestinian farmer Ahmad Burnat, who brought his first camera in 2005 to record the birth of his youngest son, the film is structured in chapters around the destruction of each one of Burnat's cameras. Again, that's Five Broken Cameras, Thursday, December 11th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Triangle Productions run of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche, starting November 28th and ending on December 20th at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza in Portland. This is a comedic look at the window of 1956's Susan B. Anthony Society for the Sisters of Gertrude Stein, as they sit in their renovated community center, sharing secrets as the threat of atomic apocalypse nibbles at their heels. Again, that's the Triangle Productions performance of Five Lesbians Eating Quiche at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This Health and Healthcare Forum is the second one from the 2014 Oregon Public Health Association Conference. First is a conversation with Dr. Margarita Alegria about her keynote address, which was titled, What We Can Learn to Do to Eliminate Disparities.